If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you are. Thanks for being here. Mark Greene, of course, is best known for his Grey Man series, The Thriller. But did you also know that he was once the co-writer, in fact, the last co-writer, with the great Tom Clancy, and even continued with Clancy's Jack Ryan series after Tom Clancy's death? Those are some big shoes, or maybe a big typewriter. I don't know. These days, though, with Mark Greene, it's all about the Grey Man. The Hardline is his latest. It's out just now. And already at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. We'll talk to him in a moment, but how about this? Rockford has its own poet laureate. Rockford? Well, why not Rockford?
My goal as the poet laureate has really been to bring people to poetry.
That's Adam Al-Serghany, Rockford's new poet laureate. We'll catch up with him in a bit. Let's start, though, with Mark Greene. Mark, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Hey, listen, okay, we'll get to the hard line, but I kind of want to start at the beginning of your career. You were working at a surgery technology company, right? And decided to write on the side, or tell me about those early days.
Yeah, I started trying to write even before I worked in the medical device field. But I just would sort of read a ton of novels and had a day job, and then got to where I kept trying to write a book, and I would write before work, and I would write on the weekends, and it went over different jobs, but it took me 15 years to finish my first novel, and then my first published novel, The Grey Man, was my fourth finished manuscript. So it was about a 20-year process from, hey, I want to be a writer, to, hey, I'm a writer.
It's another overnight success.
Yeah, exactly.
But I bring it up because the first book, as I read, was about the aftermath of the Bosnian Civil War. It was rejected, but it was a fortuitous rejection, right? The editor who turned it down said, hey, I like this character. And the character turned out to be a pretty profitable one for you.
Yeah. It was something like that. So I wrote this book about the Bosnian Civil War, and I gave it to an agent. And he's like, you're a really good writer, but, you know, nobody really understood that war when it was happening. And it was 10 years ago when I wrote it was 10 years later when I wrote the book. So he said, go write something else that has one lead character. He's like, just picture a book with a guy on the cover with a gun. And that's the book I want you to give me next. And so I came up with The Grey Man after, you know, picking around with some different things.
You know, it's funny that was your editor's advice, because I was just in Croatia and Slovenia and a couple other countries this past year. And it's, you know, they still are not telling a singular story of the war.
For sure.
Yeah. Very different versions of it. So I get that. So when the Grey Man comes along, when did you know that I got something here?
You know, I can't say I ever knew. I wrote a book called Goon Squad that had the Grey Man as the top, you know, as the hero, gave that to that agent who asked me to write something else for him. And he called me up and he said, I'm not going to tell you what you want to hear. He's like, there's probably agents that would take this on, but I think you could do a lot better if you wrote a whole nother book with this hero, but whole different plot and everything. And I remember my first thought was like, can you give me the numbers of those agents you think might go for this? Because
exactly.
I really don't want to spend another year and do this again. But he was absolutely right. I spent a day crying, and then I wrote another book, and that was The Grey Man. And it was turned down by 9 out of 10 publishers, and the 10th publisher was Tom Colgan, who is my editor publisher to this day. So it was not, you know, this thing that just blew off the doors at the beginning. It was a small paperback release, and it's built up over time.
Well, you know, you bring up something interesting that's always kept me from having the courage to write a book, or the determination, in that, you know, the idea is you sit down, you write a story, it comes out of you, and then you bring it around. But it's the rewriting, right, and the recreating and the revisions, when you have to sacrifice what you thought was a pretty good story in the beginning, that it just seems to me to be grueling.
Yes, it can be grueling. It was early enough into my career where I knew I didn't know everything, and sadly I've had conversations with other people who were like, yeah, I turned away from, you know, fixing my book or listening to what anybody else said. And these people didn't get published, you know, and I was trying to get published. And I also respected the viewpoints of other people. And the changes weren't huge changes. They were changes where I had made it a little bit more realistic. And they were like, I think the readers would love it if this happened and this happened. And I'm like, well, how does that happen? You know, in realism. And they're like, well, you're the writer. You have to come
you
up with
You figure
that.
It out, right?
Yeah, so it's tough to make those changes. But at the end of the day, I'm glad I did, of course.
Tell me a little bit about the Greenman. Who is Court Gentry?
So he is a former CIA paramilitary officer. And he's a guy that got swept up into the agency at a very young age. Worked sort of, you know, clandestine roles. And then in the first book, you know, my new book is the 15th Gray Man novel. But in the first book, the agency's trying to kill him and he doesn't know why. And it takes about five books to resolve that. Each book is a standalone novel. You don't have to read them in any order. But, you know, that's all cleared up. And then he's in different relationships at different times. But in the hard line, the new one, he is working for a unit called Ghost Town, which is a Sub Rosa clandestine spy shop that reports only to the deputy director of operations.
You seem to take on the military or the intelligence contractors in this book. I would imagine that wasn't by casually done. I mean, you must have targeted them.
I don't know. Targeted is the word. I've written books where they're the heroes in the novels. And in this book, there's a unit called Gauntlet. And they are the villains in this book. I don't know that they're corporate-wide, they're villains. But the units that Court comes up against, I really sort of wanted to play into, sadly, the paranoia going on in America right now. We're a very divided country. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of reminds me of those movies in the 70s, The Parallax View and, you know, 6 Days of the Condor, 3 Days of the Condor is a movie. And those sort of things. And I just sort of wanted to think about this kind of like stifling fear on a domestic front. I mean, I have used North Korea and China and Russia and, you know, and any permutation of that in earlier books. But in this book, the threats, you know, are coming from within the house, unfortunately.
And the threat is to the intelligence community itself. But this book's really also in many ways about family, right? I mean,
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, you know, all my books are, you know, action adventure thrillers, and this book has every bit as much action as any of my other novels, but it's a lot more nuanced and layered in that the families and the bloodlines and the histories of the characters sort of come into it. Again, you don't have to have read the first 14 books, but if you had, you would see some sort of through lines coming through that. And I had talked about Court's father in the past, and I wanted to kind of get into that a little bit more. I had talked about another major character, Zach Hightower, about his predicament in the past, and I kind of wanted to get into that in the story. And I've noticed that this Gray Man novels that people love the most are the ones that are ultimately the most personal. It's not about, you know, defusing the nuclear bomb. It's about the relationships and the personal stakes. And I kind of wanted to write about that.
Well, I can attest to the fact that each of these stand alone because this is my first Gray Man that I've read, Mark.
And, great.
You know, jumped right in. And from what I read about it, Zach Hightower is kind of a favorite side character, and you give him a little bit of a spotlight this time.
Right. Yeah. He is a character that I think I put in. Yeah. I know I put in the second book, didn't expect much out of him, and I enjoyed writing him. I enjoyed the repartee between him and Court. They're two different type of people kind of doing the same job, sometimes at each other's throats and sometimes at each other's side. And it's been fun to write about him over the years. But he has a lot of humor, but I kind of wanted to dig into, like, what is he left behind to fight in the global war on terror for 20 years and 20 years plus, and what is he sacrificed? And so you get into that in this book.
And we get into a little bit about his family. And then there's Whetstone, this man from Northern Ireland who also is driven by family.
Yeah, correct. So this is a villain who has probably more nuance than a lot of, or really any other villain that I've written before. He's a Northern Irishman in his late 40s, has a family or has had a family, and he has a very personal reason for going up against court in this book. And he is co-opted by the enemy force that's operating in America. And so he's one of five assassins in America with this role to take out members of the intelligence community. But he's really only taken that job for one reason, and that's to get over here and get to court.
You mentioned earlier the court's father and that you've used him or mentioned him in the books before, but there's really, and he had talked about being estranged. There's a poignancy to their reunion here. And I just want a little more meat on the bones of it. At one point, Gentry, I think it was Whetstone, was talking about it's all about family. And Gentry said, oh, well, I wouldn't know about that.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
But in the end, he does know about that.
Yeah. So he was estranged from his father when he was 18 or 19 years old and has only seen him in person once and has not spoken to him. In one of the earlier books, I think book five in the series, he's in the same room with his dad, but neither can acknowledge the other one because of the circumstances. And I'd always thought there would be this, you know, kind of moment where they would see each other, but neither of these men are, you know, the hug it out types and, you know, just pat each other on the back. But there's a warmth there and there's a shared, you know, history. And so I wanted to do that in a way that wasn't just like fan service where everybody got to see what they've been waiting for. I wanted it to feel realistic.
No, I think you caught that. I mean, it was very, very nice scenes there in the book. When it comes to Whetstone, I know you're known for your research. You went to Northern Ireland. Well, how did you find it?
I loved it. And, you know, a fascinating thing, I just did an interview today and somebody said, what was the biggest surprise of that you learned writing this book? And, you know, I don't usually think in those terms, but I was like, you know, I spent a good amount of time in South Armagh, which is known as really the hotbed of the Troubles, the Northern Ireland. I mean, the British in as late as the late 90s had to travel through South Armagh in helicopter gunships or armored cars. And, you know, I spent 10 days there in a farm, and it just was among one of the most peaceful places I've ever been. But there's still this sectarian, I mean, you see graffiti for the IRA, or you see huge murals to IRA, you know, soldiers who fell to the British. And these, you know, you're around people who are just couldn't be kinder or more giving, but that's still there. That is not ancient history to them at all. And I felt some of that in Belfast as well. I spent a good amount of time in Belfast. And I can't say that I went all over Belfast. It's obviously there's the Protestant side and the Catholic side, but I definitely, just in the center of town, felt that as well.
Yeah, I was there just last year, and you mentioned Bosnia, and it's hard to understand. I think it's hard for us to understand the Troubles too, because we tend to romanticize Ireland and not see Northern Ireland. And I mean, it's, I don't know that you've been to the Republic, but they're still very different. And I have friends and I had a writer once tell me, I won't give his name, it's been many years, but that from the Republic, that he still wasn't comfortable, you know, walking around in parts of Belfast. So you're right, it's still there.
Yeah, it's still very much there, and it is hard for us Americans to understand. It would, you know, it would be like, I guess, if our Civil War ended 30 years ago, you know, to some degree, and you were you know, a guy from New Jersey walking around Alabama, that might mean something.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The fight scenes, the gunfire is intricate. When I'm thinking particularly of the shoothouse late in the book, that's just one scene. We don't have to talk about the specifics there, but when you're writing those scenes, do you choreograph them out in your head? Do you maybe write them as a dance and then put the prose around it? Because there's a lot to keep track of there, Mark.
Yes. And I've always felt, for one reason or another, the action scenes are the easiest scenes for me to write. I struggle with everything else, but I also kind of like think about everything else and brood over everything else. And when I'm walking my dog, it's not me trying to work out an action scene in my head. Those things kind of come while I'm sitting there at the page. at the computer, you know, working on that page, whereas the conversations between a father and his son, or, you know, some sort of conflict, or how does a character get in without a passport to this country? Those are the things that kill me, that I tear myself up. But the action scenes kind of, I won't say they write themselves. I have a lot of experience with firearms, and I've studied a lot of tactics and taken a lot of courses and, you know, battlefield medicine and all that kind of stuff. So I like to work those things in. And now this is my 15th Gray Man book, but my 27th published novel. And I'm, now it's all about not doing something I've done before. So no matter what the fight scene is, there has to be something unique about it or different.
Well, it's probably good for your dog that you don't think about it while you're walking him, because he can pick up on that. It could be trouble.
Yeah. You sniff that out.
Do you worry that you will run out of ideas?
Absolutely. My main worry is not even really my main worry, but the hardest part of my job now is I can't use the first thing that I think of, and I can't use the second thing that I think of. If I'm thinking like, oh, I need a villain to represent, Chinese interest, I can't use the top spy in China. I can't use a Ministry of State Security guy who is, you know, from their, you know, Golden Eagle Battalion of Special Force. You know, I can't do that because I've done that before.
Right.
I have to use some proxy from Belgium who, has been brought over and was raised by monks, or, you know, that hasn't happened, but, you know, something like that.
Jot it down. You might need it, though.
I might end up using that. And my joke with my editor is like, you know, the day that I realize I'm writing my second knife fight in a pot tub is the day I know that just to hang it up, and I've done everything.
Well, the Gray Man got the film treatment, Ryan Gosling, a Netflix film. Does that change the way you write your books? Do you write that with the movies or TV in mind sometimes?
No, not at all. I mean, it was the finished product was very, very different from the books. I thought Ryan Gosling was fantastic. I thought he was the best part of the whole thing. I think the books are grittier. The story, even in the first book, The Gray Man, that they adapted to film, the story was different in a lot of ways. So I've always just seen the books as their own thing. And the film was the best advertisement I could have possibly had for the books. But, you know, if I tried to write to film, it would be like as if the screenwriters were trying to write my book.
Right.
You know, it's different.
It's good because I could see where there'd be sort of a temptation to lure you in to write with movies in mind. And then you're in
right.
Cheating yourself out of your own product in many ways.
Right, right. And, you know, I have the luxury of 150,000 words to tell a story that they have, I have 550 full pages and they have 110 right. Very sparse pages.
I want to talk to you too, but you mentioned all the number of books you've read. Of course, people familiar with you would all know that you had a collaboration with Tom Clancy, right? Were the last to co-write with him. Did you ever say, Tom, that's a bad idea, this is how it should go? Or how did those collaborations work?
I never said anything like that at all. And in fact, I remember sitting in his office one time. Most of the time we weren't together. But I remember sitting in his office and I was very kind of excited about some research that I had done about something about Chinese fifth generation fighters. And I was talking about something about the development of this and how it could be used. And he just sort of like waved a hand in the air and he said, yeah, they're getting most of their components from the French, or something along those lines.
Right,
where
he
just kind of like, I didn't even totally like, unfold my idea, but, you know, it was just kind of poo-pooed without him even doing that intentionally.
How did the collaboration work? Did he give you ideas that you put, that you fleshed out? Or I'm interested in how that...
You know, it's been 10 years since I wrote a Clancy book, and it's been sadly almost 15 years since he passed away in 2013, but I signed an NDA to not talk about the specifics of it, but it was a collaboration, and, you know, I got to meet him and make sure, you know, I guess he got to, you know, sign off on me working with him. And, you know, we did the three books before we had just finished Command Authority, the third one, when he passed away. And I remember thinking, like, it's probably going to take them years to figure out if they want to continue the series. And it was just a couple weeks later, they're like, we want to do two next year, and we want you to write both of them.
They're all Jack Ryan books, right?
All the ones I did were Jack Ryan. One of them really didn't focus on Jack Ryan or Jack Ryan Jr. It focused on another character in the series, but they were all part of the Jack Ryan universe. Yeah.
So I would imagine when you carry it on yourself, that there was great pressure there. Right? True or no?
Absolutely. Great pressure. Yeah. I mean, the worst pressure was at the very beginning when I was asked to collaborate with him. I just remember being completely intimidated and, you know, wanting to get out of it secretly, but knowing that my agent would, you know, come down to Memphis and, you know, beat me up.
Right.
But, you know, by the time I'd done three with him, I felt like I was the right person to carry it on. But I really had it in my head that fans were going to not be happy about this at all. And sure, it was just the opposite. When I went on my first tour, I was just ready for, you know, to get the tomatoes thrown at me. And these people, so many people were just like, thank you so much for keeping these characters going. And it was wonderful.
You know, that's funny. That reminds me of a story. It's not exactly the same, but I have a friend who was a great college football player and was drafted for Kansas City, as I recall. This has been decades ago. And he's there and he's just over his head. You know, it's just like, this is the NFL. And he got cut and it was the happiest day of his life. It's like, thank God, right? But you can't walk away from it. You've got to give it your fight. And obviously you didn't get cut. You did very well.
Yeah, yeah. But it was initially when they said, how would you like to write a book with Tom Clancy? And I'd only had two paperbacks out at that time. And I kept thinking, why can't I write a book with like the next guy up the food chain from me? Why does it have to be the guy at the top of the ladder? You know, I'm just trying to get a hand on it.
We're talking to Mark Rainey. The name of this book is The Hardline. It's the latest Gray Man series. Okay, so the last page or so, did you preview the next book? There's something happens, I should say. I'm not going to tell what it is.
But. Yes. I didn't really know where I was going other than, you know, very, very general things. But I knew that this story that I was telling in The Hardline was a very, very big story. And it has sort of two main components. There's the personal and then there's the larger government conspiracy that's involved. And I wanted to resolve one of those, and the other one I wanted to continue to build on for at least another book. And so the end of this book, yes, there something happens at the very end of this book to where the story in this book is resolved except for this part, and then there's one more big aha moment at the end. So yeah, that's the book 16. I'm working on it now. I just went to did some research in the Alps in Austria a couple weeks ago, and I'm going to be in the Cayman Islands doing some research and back up in the DC area. So I'm hard at work at next year's book.
I have a business where I take groups to Europe and I love the travel of it. Do you still love that travel? I mean, or is it now, I don't want to say it's getting old for you, but it's part of the job. It's getting a little more routine, or do you still sort of jaw dropping? Wow. This is great.
Oh, I love it. Love it. Love it. You know, and I like going to places I haven't been. I've been to Austria before, but I had never been to this area. I had an idea. I have a bad habit, or just the way the year works out, that I never travel. I never do my location research in the season in which the story is in the book. So if it's like a winter season, I'm there in August, and that always happens. And so this year, I got the idea that I wanted to do part of it in the Austrian Alps, and it takes place in January or February. And I was like, oh, I have a tiny little window just in a couple of weeks. Can I actually make this happen and go to Europe in a couple of weeks? And so I did. I got to do the trip in the right season, which was fantastic. And, you know, I hate being away from home. I have four dogs and my wife doesn't get to go with me on all of these trips. She goes some. So I, you know, there's things I miss at home, but I love to get out and get away and spend 24 hours a day thinking about the book.
Mark Rainey, the latest Gray Man book is The Hardline, and he's already previewed 16 for us. So we'll read this one and look forward to the next one. It was nice to meet you and talk to you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Poetry now, Midwest style. Adam L. Sergany is the new poet laureate for Rockford, Illinois. Adam, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be sitting down with a legend, Steve.
Okay, we'll have enough of that. No more legend talk here, unless it's going to be about you. But tell me about that. Why does Rockford have a poet laureate?
Yeah. What I want to remind our Chicago listeners is we started our Poet Laureate program in 2020, which means that we beat you by a couple years. You know, I'm Rockford's fourth Poet Laureate, and I've got some big shoes to fill after Lydia Kozlowski and and Jenna Goldsmith. But, you know, we, the goal of the Poet Laureate position is really to help people in the community access poetry and the literary arts. And it's a big part of what I'm hoping to do.
And so you'll do that in what way? Library programs, school programs, McDonald's programs?
You know, it's been really interesting to watch who actively has been requesting already poems or poetic programs. And it's a really wide variety. The Poet Laureate programs, in conjunction with the Rockford Public Library, the city, and the Rockford Area Arts Council. But, you know, my goal as the Poet Laureate has really been to bring people to poetry. I've told a number of people about this, but a friend of my mother's had reached out. She knew I was a writer, but didn't know I wrote poetry. And she wrote me to say, you know, I found out about you being the Poet Laureate, and I went and I looked you up and I read this poem of yours and it didn't rhyme, you know? And I think there's this desire for language and for beautiful language. And oftentimes people need an access point. And so I'm hoping to work with the library in particular to help find some access points.
Well, you know, you strike me as an optimist, and in a way you're already having an influence. Your mom's friend has been introduced to poetry in a way that she hasn't, and now she's telling all her friends it doesn't rhyme. It makes no sense to her. Your dad's from Egypt. Your mom is, I'm assuming, from Northwest Illinois, or
That's right. At any rate,
you talk about how this the mix of Arab and small town America or Midwest sort of fuels your outlook on life, and I've been trying to figure out exactly how that tea would taste. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah. So my father was a jeweler from Cairo, and a long line of jewelers who bounced over to America after the assassination of Sadat, which was, I promise, more about just political change than about his participation there. You know, he stumbled into the Midwest and into the small town Midwest and married my mother, who was a school teacher in Lena, Illinois. Outside of Stockton, where we live. And, you know, my father would take us to Rockford for holidays. He would take us to the mosque. And, you know, he thought about the Quran as a kind of poetics, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about the Islamic zikr, there's La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. And then we'd be, you know, riding home in the car, and it's, you know, Chicago's own Warren Zevon going, "Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again." And, you know, it's that combination, I think, for me that really, at a very young age, introduced me to the musicality of language. And it stuck with me, and later would help me kind of find poetry on the page and poetry as a performance.
Well, I hope you can have an impact, because right now when the people of Chicago think of Stockton, they don't think of poets, they think of speed traps, right? That's the Chicagoans driving to Galena usually get pulled over in Stockton by one of their very own.
Yeah, this is definitely me speaking out of turn, but once upon a time, an old cop did tell me he used to sit just outside of town and watch for fancy cars so he could tag people from Chicago as they were going out.
Yeah, you're not telling me anything that we don't know here in the city. I've run that gauntlet several times. Okay, but so Stockton, rural Illinois, you tell some wonderful stories. We won't get into it here, about mowing acres of grass because you have to keep up appearances on the farm. I love that. I grew up in farm territory, you know, and then you drive by and you're like, why are those farmers mowing their 3-acre front yard? But it's just something they do. Oh, but I mean, you lived in Cairo, you lived in New York, Philadelphia, Tucson, but you say there's something about the rural Midwest that allows for, well, I don't know what the term would be, an expansion of peace, consciousness, or, I mean, explain it for me.
Yeah, I mean, I was a ghostwriter in New York for several years. I lived in Cairo for a little while. We're talking about, you know, megalopolises and cities that are always kind of busy and bustling and overwhelming, especially in a place like New York, where it's also sort of living expenses are so high. And there are so many people that like travel, right? The distance from the farm I grew up on to my home in Rockford is way less than, you know, going from one end to Brooklyn to the other. But the process of getting from one end of Brooklyn to the other involves so many interactions and so much intensity, right? There's something for me about, you know, this is especially true in rural Joe Davis County or many very rural spaces where landscape is literally gridded in mile by mile blocks. But there's something about the kind of continuousness of corn or even just in Rockford, my ability to walk down to the grocery in relative peace that allows for a lot more room to think and to take in the sort of the small nuances of the world around me.
You know, it's interesting. I had never considered it until you started talking there about they tell us here, well, I'm in an urban area, but or in rural or anywhere, you know, that we're not at with ourselves anymore. We're with our phones, right? We're looking at our phones. Yeah. But that's the kind of what you're describing in urban areas. They've before the cell phone or the portable computer, they were dealing with all that input data already, right? So that it makes it even more intense for them. Maybe that's where we're headed. We're all going to be New Yorkers one day.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I hope we stay a little more diverse than that, which is only slightly a bag on New York. But
you're a poet, but you just came out with a short story collection last year. Tell me about More Hell.
Yeah. So More Hell is a collection of 16 short stories set in the Driftless Midwest. So in that kind of Joe Davis County into Wisconsin, rural Iowa area. It was published by a female-led press, Whiskey Tit Books, out of Vermont. And it, you know, it follows a series of characters in a kind of Winesburg, Ohio way, although I wouldn't say it's sort of interconnected in the way that, say, like A Visit from the Goon Squad is. The characters recur, but they're sort of living loosely in their own worlds in different times. And it's really exploring sort of two big thoughts in narrative. One is, right, like hell being other people. And the other is Mary Ellen Leese's, this is not a quote she actually had said, that she was a farm labor organizer and supposedly had said, raise less corn and more hell. And when asked about it, she said, I didn't say that, but it's right bit good of advice. And I, having grown up amongst farmers, I've always found that deeply endearing.
I wish you the best. I congratulate you. And I think it's fantastic. I think Rockford made a great choice.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to sit down with you.
All right, podcast is over. I want you to go find a poem now. Read it slowly. Let it wash over you. Take it all in. It would make Adam proud. Thanks for listening to Steve Bertrand on Books this week. I'm glad you're here, and I hope you'll spread the word as we get this little project growing. Got a comment about something you heard or maybe something you didn't hear? I'd love to hear from you either way, any which way, at stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. That's stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. Or you can follow me on Facebook as well. Until next week, be well.